Yes, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Appreciate you taking the time. So perhaps a question you are tired of or delighted by is I found a Matthias Buss on a website claiming a number 5 position in a Rubik's Cube competition in 2008. Is that you?
No, that's not me.
Okay.
Well, that's a good guess.
Yeah. There was a hyphen.
That's good though. I can see how all the signals are aligning. But
on the name, right? Yeah. Well, so you know, okay. So you're not a Rubik's Cube master, but you have for measure contributed roughly 1,000 NPM modules. Is that you, right?
Yeah. Okay. I learned to. So it's actually funny you mentioned that because I think about this a lot. I came up through went to school and all this stuff. And I studied math at university. And one of the things that was very, very, that I always think about to set the stage for my career was like this, the humbling, I would call it. When you like study something like math, where there's like an appeal for a very certain amount of people, you come in, you're like, maybe I like playing chess. Maybe I'm good at chess. Maybe I like doing the Rubik's Cubes. And then you just meet these people who are like twice as good. 5 times as good, 10 times humbling. As good, 100 times as good. And you just realize, wow, okay, I can never compete with that. So I got to compete with something else. And then you learn how to maybe navigate how other things work.
Shift lanes.
And I often think about that when you have an experience like that, you can either become like a person who's like resentful from that, or you can kind of like learn from that and grow into something else. And I like to think that I did the latter part. Maybe I am resentful.
Yeah.
I don't know. But like,
I misattribute this, so I won't try, but someone wise said, you know, that you should continue to sort of niche down until you become the best in the world at what you're doing, which, you know, it looks good on a coffee mug. It's a little harder in practice, but I think, the reason I mentioned the 1,000 NPM modules, and for those who do not know, Node.js is a, let's just say at a high level, an application development framework. And the bottom line is, Matthias, you have contributed a astounding amount of open source code. And so I point that out, and I sort of raise that as a sense of what drives you. And I won't presume to speak for you, but of course we're going to talk about hole punch and other work. But, you know, let's start here. Like, what has been the through line so far in, from studying mathematics to work where you are now, in essence, trying to sort of rip the centralization out of major, you know, applications that we use every day? Like, what drives that?
That's a super good question. I think in general, I'm very driven by the power of the individual, I think. I think that's like a lot of people in our space are like that. And what I mean by that is actually just very egotistically, what can I do as a person myself to make an impact on my surroundings? When I went to school, I didn't know programming. And I only had like done a bit of mathematics and stuff, and I was very interested in that. And part through the school, we got introduced to that because they wanted us to have a job afterwards, and it was like a requirement. That was one of the first time I kind of like got the sense of like I said, the power of the individual, where, wow, I can learn something. I can write, I'm pretty good at writing some code, as most people can. And I can just publish that online, and you can take it, and you don't even have to talk to me, and you can run that code, and now you can use that to do something else and contribute back, and we can kind of like snowball from there. And we don't need to involve any kind of like organization. We don't need to have any kind of funding. We can just kind of do this on our own time, obviously, with like limitations and stuff like that. But it's this like unhinged productivity and like creativity that unlocks immediately spoke to me, because I just felt like, wow, I can just, it's just like the more I put in, the more I get out. So it was actually somehow a very quick path from like writing like one module to like writing 1,000, because it's just kind of like going like that. And it's like self-triggering, you know? So I'm a big believer in just doing things. Software for me, obviously, that's all that feels, but software for me.
Yeah. I mean, if one is going to have a compulsion, I have kid. This is a great compulsion, you know, and I got my first computer at age 8, way before the internet. But every time I speak with someone who does what you do professionally, who writes code, who engineers software, who builds systems, I'm reminded of, you know, and I think you say half tongue in cheek that it's egotistical, but that just surge of power, that you are godlike in your command of this machine, you know, and the machine that used to sit on our desks has now become, you know, the internet and a global system. I was, I was talking to some friends, and I got a humble PR merged into Omarkey. I can't, DHH's new, you know, which I'm running. It's great. And again, not a developer, you know, not a professional developer, but to do something like that at that level is just joy, you know. And so for me, a novice, a hobbyist, to do that, much less, you know, someone who's you know, it's that classic image of the entire global internet infrastructure in that one little module, you know. And so you got 1,000x chance to be that one module. Well, so with that, let's shift, Matthias, in to Hole Punch, Pear, Keet. Talk us through the order of events that led to taking on what now is Hole Punch and the associated technologies.
Yeah, and I think actually it's funny, we didn't discuss this before, but it's a very good lead up into that, because I think so just from an experience of like being an open source developer, like you said, just, you know, you can command your machine, you can just produce code. The biggest hurdle I ever experienced in that as a person who was just like very curious and just wanted to make a lot of things was actually like, it was actually really easy to write code, but making products and making applications and making services, although not insanely hard, had a whole different entry level of problems. Like it's kind of like, I couldn't make 1,000 products, because every time I would be like, I have to like set up some infrastructure, and like if that infrastructure gets a lot of traction, it might be a problem. So I wouldn't just like host files online, because I did that once and I got like a big bill, right? Like everybody just tried to do things.
To say nothing of UI UX and all the attendant capital P product sorts of challenges.
Yeah. And I had this experience with open source, which I think was very, very interesting, where like you would just write stuff and a lot of it would get like no traction. So you would write something and you'd be like, wow, this is really good, and get no traction. And then that weird thing that you never thought would really go anywhere would all of a sudden just take off. And that always stuck to me of like this, like if you just produce, you know, 1,000 things, just like math, right? Like 1% of them are popular. That's like a lot of them. And, but I never got that stuff with like the products. And I'm not a very good product guy, and, you know, like there's a lot of people good at that. So I need the numbers game, right? And at the same time, I got very interested, also for the same reason, in just classic peer-to-peer back then. So one of the open source modules I wrote was a BitTorrent client, which I'm sure a lot of your viewers are familiar with, which is like, you know, a protocol for exchanging files between each other that was very, very big in the early 2000s.
And highly resilient.
Highly resilient. And this was like around the peak of that, I started to dabble in that. And it gave me that kick again of like, I could just use my laptop and I could just write software and interact with it with this network. It was not easy, but it also wasn't, you know, insanely hard. And I could just access this whole network of content out there, and I could make these crazy novel applications. I made like 100 different small things. So it was just like doing weird stuff with this network. And a lot of it took off, right, to get very popular. And all of a sudden, I had this connect up like, wow, I can not only just write code, I can also actually provide content, like add that second layer. And once you have operational like code and you have content, you basically have a product. Like you still need some UI and stuff, but like at least now like the two biggest parts of that is solved. And so I would do that. I got very triggered by that. I did a lot of stuff, and it always came back to me of like, it's kind of sad that I can actually only make apps right now to interact with BitTorrent. And back then, BitTorrent was honestly just used for piracy. So it's kind of like every app you did would, unless you wanted to play that game, would never really go anywhere.
Right.
It would be like a piracy app. And I was always like, wow, well, this has way more strength in other spaces also, right? So we can do this other thing. So I got very, very interested in trying to take these protocols and apply them for like generalized networks. So like, how can we, instead of just exchanging big files, how can we do this to exchange any kind of data?
And that's HyperCore?
That's HyperCore. That's one of the things I wrote. Again, like just one of those files and modules, just cranked them out.
Sure.
And it basically set me down of this path of like, okay, we need to do some R&D. We need to figure some stuff out. We need to talk to a bunch of, again, smart people, the Rubik's Cube people, like myself.
Yeah, right. Speedrunners.
Speedrunners get a lot of outside help. But like build up a series of technological capabilities so we can start taking those kind of data networks, fuse them into apps, and just have basically a platform, a series of modules where we can make tons of them with no cost, with just like this iteration speed.
And by that, let me ask Matthias, I take you to mean, and again, for those who, you know, may not be builders or developers themselves, as you noted, if you're going to spin up an open source module, some code, let's just sort of generalize this and put it on GitHub, put it on the internet, let you know, others do what they will with it. That's one thing. To create a product, to spin up a product means, you know, potentially thousands of dollars in cost on AWS or some other provider. So the point is you've got all this infrastructure cost. You know, you don't build a home without a foundation, and you don't build a product without a foundation as well. And so if I hear you correctly, the itch to scratch was, how do I remove that condition of the foundation, the infrastructure, and just rapidly deploy these useful, interesting applications? Is that fair?
Exactly. And not even just usual, but also just like crazy, like this like left field ideas of like, let's try to do something really different. And it's very interesting what cost means also, I think, because for me, you know, it wasn't that, you know, paying $5 for something was expensive, but it's that thing of like, everybody knows this when they go to a website and they ask for $5 to do something. You're like, the transactional aspect of that is just immediately kills things, because it's like this weird hurdle. And also like, it's $5 now. What if I have a 1,000 users? Maybe it's like $10,000, et cetera, et cetera. So getting that out of the way all of a sudden meant that we could start building these apps and not think about it. And I think that's what I was really, really interested in from a technological point. Now, I've been very, very blessed in my career, because it's actually a very, very hard pitch to go to somebody and say like, hey, let's build something where we take away the transactional aspect of it, but we allow people to build. Kind of like,
And we monetize this how, right?
Yeah. Which it's the same if you try to get funding for open source stuff. Back then, at least, it would be like, I don't understand. And so I was very lucky in my career to meet like the right people to help with that, like aka Tether and the crowd there, who was big mind shares of that vision, because there's tons of ways to monetize these things, but like not in a traditional aspect like that. So like basically build out the technology, build a platform, try to make this again comprehensible for normal people. As you can see, I get very excited talking about it and like
that's great
technical aspects, but like turn it into something like normal people can build on, and then just have people build and like just try out 1,000 things. I think one of the biggest sparks for somebody trying to do like an iteration phase of like building products and building things is like, you get that one first user, right? And you get the 2 users and you get the 10 users. And like that interaction thing is just motivating like anything else.
Certainly.
And that's what building these things is all about, especially for other people. So
that's awesome.
That's basically what we're trying to do at Hole Punch. Just build up.
Yeah. And it's early. You're now 3 years in. Is that right, Matthias?
Yeah. 3 or 4 years. And we've been working on the technology for longer, because it's just been, you know, crazy.
Sure. And I would imagine, as you noted, there are some strata, some layers that have been building over time. Well, let me ask this, if we zoom out, and I don't want to map this onto your motivations, but I do want to ask, I mean, we all know centralized platforms, Meta, Google, X, they dominate our lives, our digital lives. They, you know, control data, they censor content at will. And ultimately, I would argue they're eroding user sovereignty. I mean, I'm sure you saw that, Google has now announced that even to sideload an application on Android, you must, you know, to basically play on Android, you must KYC as a developer. Yep. And so my question is, be it the origin or now, sort of what fundamental flaws in this gatekeeper walled garden model are you targeting with Hole Punch's P2P tech? And you know, how do they pave the way for a more trustless, decentralized internet? Big questions, but I think they're important ones.
I think it's super true. And I think also there's like multiple aspects of that. Like, obviously there's like an aspect that's technology and like how we can make the technology that allows people to do this, which is basically what I talked about. There's obviously also a non-technical side of this, which is like just, and I actually wonder about this a lot myself, like how did we let it get to this? I feel like we had obviously a huge revolution with mobile devices.
Yes.
And yet we pay for them, and yet somehow we still don't really own them.
Don't own them. Absolutely.
And we just somehow accept that because, you know, it's almost a little bit too late on that. I mean, we still need to fight back, but we're very deep in that thing now. And
yes.
And it's a disaster, and we need to think of ways to get out of that. And like obviously peer-to-peer tech is part of that, but it's also like just a peer-to-peer mentality. Outside that is a big part of it. You mentioned like Omar Key earlier, like that kind of like movement on desktop computers about owning hardware. I think that's really important. And I wish we can get like a, and it's going to happen like a similar kind of revolution going on mobile devices.
This will also be the year of the Linux desktop.
Yeah. I mean, like it's pretty good, but at least like, you know, I'm still somewhat concerned and surprised that I can still install stuff in my, you know, I have a MacBook, right? I feel like, because the way things are going on mobile devices, they're just locking it down more and more.
Absolutely.
So
and you have to assume it's coming, right? I think the only reason
it's not here is because they only care about the market share on phones, because it's like 90%, right? But
absolutely.
So that concerns me a lot, and that's something also we're concerned about internally, and also like building up alternatives for. And like again, technology is going to be a big part of that, but it's not the end all solution.
Right. And so with that, do you mean to say, would Hole Punch and partners take on awareness education? Like, does the mission expand to include that? Or are you just rightly saying that absolutely that is necessary?
I mean, we are always trying to look ahead and see what's coming. And like also both on like, should we make more hardware or should we do other stuff? And like,
right.
Because it's just from a personal point of view, it frustrates me dearly that the phone is the ultimate device.
Yes.
Like, I have it has a radio, it's always connected, yet I can run software in the background on my phone. It's the ultimate peer-to-peer device, but it's also the hardest one to develop for because of restrictions that is forced upon me. So it's something we're continuously thinking about and like trying to do stuff for, and also both for end users. I think right now it's interesting you mentioned like, again, like Omar Key, because I don't even know, even as a slightly technical person,
yes.
It's like my options on phones right now is very limited. I can like maybe try to flash an Android device, but it's tough, right? So even for us, people who are willing to invest it, it's too hard, and we need to do more stuff to make it easier. Now, with like if we had phones that were more permissive and stuff like that, you still need peer-to-peer to deliver software, because again, any kind of like centralized store is going to go through the same kind of process that everything
yes.
else centralized goes through, with like restrictions and like liabilities and like et cetera, et cetera. So it's absolutely cornerstone technology-wise that these things are peer-to-peer. But again, there's like a hardware aspect here that's really important also.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, those who know me are probably ready for me to shut up about my move from 2007, my first iPhone, to 2 months ago, a Pixel running Graphene OS. You know, I won't stop talking about it. And it is a lift. I mean, even, you know, for someone technical, it is tricky. But to your point, I had forgotten that, you know, I mean, I say this half joking, I had almost forgotten this is a computer. And I ought to be able to run background processes at will,
yeah.
You know, and again, for those not non-nerds, you know, just means run the code that I want the way I want. And to open that, to unlock that, you know, and I've been using Keat since shortly after launch, you know, incredibly effective. I mean, I swapped out for Zoom calls some time ago. And so, you know, now the I guess the point is the performance of that and any application can be throttled, can be hindered mm-hmm. by Android, iOS. And I think I appreciate, tell me if you disagree, that presumably that began in the interest of having or delivering a better experience to the consumer, so that you don't sort of, you know, bork your own device and have a bad experience. But ultimately, it has just become more and more restrictive. And so, let me ask this then. So let's zoom in a bit. The pair runtime, this P2P, peer-to-peer architecture, how does it affect assumptions about trust as compared to centralized cloud platforms? And so again, for those who just know, you know, they access a website, they download or run an application. I think most of us know there's something back there somewhere. And as the saying goes, the cloud is just someone else's computer. And so the operative question these days is whose? So help us understand sort of fundamentally the shift from what ages ago was client server and now it's client cloud, you know, to peer to peer. What does that really mean?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And obviously really important. I think it's like you said, it's about just following the journey, right? Like a lot of applications today, especially on desktop, I'll talk about desktop, that's a little bit easier to understand, I think, but it's same on mobile. You open a web browser, you type something in. It's actually the centralization starts immediately there because you type in some sort of name. So you go to google.com or something. So there's like a centralized registry where, you know, that gets resolved into some series of servers. And as I remember from my working back with like BitTorrent back then, that's how they tried to take down the torrent networks first.
Was
like,
absolutely.
Let's get them delisted. And it was very effective. Like other things would pop up, but like, it's like first point of attack for both censorship and also just like, you don't really have any control. Now the next problem is like, if you connect to something there, like where is that stuff hosted? And like you said, nobody hosts anything anymore. It's all like big data centers. Those data centers are often like concentrated in big data centers, but also like in jurisdictions you might not have any rights in. So I think about this a lot. I'm a person from a small country. I'm from Denmark with 5 million people. The amount of foreign data centers I use to do like my normal things, online is crazy. And as a small nation that has no army and stuff like that, like we basically have, at the end of the day, very few rights as citizens, because like we're in the system of like centralization. So when you access government services and stuff like that in a small country, like it's very often it's interesting to think about, like, what does it actually mean? It's like, it's kind of crazy. We take all our sensitive stuff and we put it somewhere else. And
right.
Is it viable to move those things back? Hard to say, because it's like that infrastructure doesn't exist. But we
and
all
is it
that.
Denmark? Sorry, Matthias. Is it Denmark, by the way, that is in this process, or at least stating that they intend to move away from Microsoft Cloud Services? They're trying to repatriate, to your point.
Yeah, and they've been trying to do that for many years, and like it's just very, very hard because of the scale of economics, right? It's like, can you make us data center yourself as a small country? Do you have that expertise when you're
right
a few million people? Maybe you get lucky and you do, maybe you don't. But the point I'm trying to get is like, this is like a problem we've created for ourselves, because basically we have the technology to make all this stuff self-hosted through P2P networks, through other ways of like saying, well, instead of caring where the data lives, let's just care about how we authenticate the data. So if I go to a website, the only thing I really care about is like that the person I'm getting the data from is like cryptographically signed this data. So I can like, to put to normal people, that I can verify that this data is correct.
Yes.
That I can verify that it's encrypted, like that, you know, there's nobody listening to it. But where it's hosted and stuff like that is really, really not important. It's just kind of like this arbitrary constraint we put for ourselves.
And I would just inject one more thing, which is, you know, speaking of Switzerland, and I'm a big advocate of and customer of Proton, I know that they are considering moving their hosting, their systems rather, out of Switzerland for concerns over data privacy protections. And so, you know, I think it might, if you would, in this sort of speak to how P2P, you know, kind of obviates or addresses, to your point, the question of jurisdiction. And I think, for those, again, who may not be following this as closely, it's gone beyond, you know, what device do I run? What app store do I use? What reliable sort of back end is powering the application to in what jurisdiction does my data sit at rest and what protections or lack thereof do I enjoy as a result, you know, all back to trust, all back to who can I trust? And so, you know, let's go to sort of P2P tackling all these things.
So P2P actually is kind of like, this is what I always tell people, it's just like, it's actually just the simplest way of doing it. So instead of you have a third party having your data, I have my data, you have your data. And when we're talking to each other, we're just talking directly. You can bank more complicated networks like that, adding more people and stuff. But like at the end of the day, that's what it's about.
I'm tempted to make the Protestant versus Catholic. There's an intermediary or you're talking direct. So
yeah.
I'll get in trouble for that one. But
maybe both are somewhat centralized through the big guy upstairs.
Touché.
And I find P2P very interesting in that because it's kind of like this attack by the masses where it's like every jurisdiction I want. So it's no jurisdiction. It's like data is everywhere and nowhere, I always say. And that obviously creates a bunch of challenges, but that's what we're trying to solve with our technology of like, that shouldn't never bubble up to the user. Just kind of like, I always say, it's kind of like when you make a centralized network, you don't really, as a developer, think about like things like packet drop. That's like the technology handles that, kind of like in peer-to-peer. You don't really think about where data is. The technology handles that.
Right.
But it gives you this much stronger foundation where it's just the people on and their devices and their hard drives and their networks. Obviously, you can have, you know, if the government in Denmark wanted to run some nodes to help, they would just spin up some computers. Like, I have my computer. It's as simple as that. Or you can, they can buy something. And then all of a sudden, you can have these networks where you can have it be as contained as possible. You can have it be as decentralized as possible. And you have all the options. And like you said earlier, you have all the data sovereignty yourself. So you don't have to give your data away. You can just control it. And the cost is spread out between the peers in the network, which then means that it's basically like basically free because we just spread it out. So it's like for these kind of things, it's just strong upsides, obviously more technologically advanced, but like all upside. And that's interesting. And it's very interesting to reflect on because I've been talking about this for, 15 years now. And there was a long period in time in the early 2000s where this was like, no, we're moving to the cloud kind of thing. And now in the last, obviously in the last 5 years, that's been a big move towards like, oh boy.
Oops. Yeah.
Maybe that wasn't the best idea for various reasons. And especially in Europe now also like with you know, the security aspects and that, there's tons of problems with that. So it's an interesting time to be alive and it's a very good time for P2P, let's put it that way.
Yes, well said. I mean, and I think to the point you just raised, whether it's the Online Safety Act in the UK, which, you know, I my heart goes out to those in the UK dealing with the absolute speed run to dystopia that the UK government is taking you through, to the broader EU. You know, every day we wake up and there is a new challenge, whether it is, you know, Signal, whether it is VPNs. And so this onslaught of bureaucrats who will hold up safety as the almighty goal, but are eroding the security and the privacy and the integrity of these technologies. Let me ask you this. Has anyone come knocking? Like, have you had challenges or have you gotten sort of, you know, people telegraphing to you that no, you know, to remove the intermediary, to remove the back end, to remove the cloud service means we can't, you know, serve you a warrant and demand data. So what does that look like in your world?
Yeah, it's a good question, right? And I think as with any kind of other bureaucratic systems, the people running those bureaucratic systems are very far removed from the reality of normal people. And I'm a very big, I'm very concerned about just the general direction of this and like this war on encryption is the only way I can kind of phrase it.
Good way to summarize. Like,
which is, as a math person, it's like, you know,
what's going on? A war on math, right?
War on math, yeah. Like who wins that one? It's very, very concerning. And it's also very, very short-sighted just from a society point of view.
Yes.
And I think regulators are like over-focused on some concerns and they're not thinking about the big picture. and I, you know, thinking about things like basic liberties of people, and like it frustrates me a lot. Even when you just think about, I'm a history buff, and like when I think about it, just like a couple hundred years ago, and with all the lack of liberties there also were back then. But like when, you know, we think about the founding of nations and like how you write in like certain rights and constitutions, and like I remember reading in the Danish constitution, there's a big section about male privacy, right? Like the privacy of male. And I'm like, how that's very important to them. And,
yes.
And then today they're like, well, let's read all the messages.
Absolutely. How quickly so we forget.
How quickly we forget, even though it's like clearly something that's, you know, on everybody's mind. So it's something we have to all be thinking about. Like I said also before, it's not just a technological battle. It's something we have to also take up on a political point of view.
Certainly.
We're definitely doing our part on the technological part. I don't know, it's hard to say what's going to rescue Europe in this way. I think they're just on a very, very bad course. Luckily, there's a lot of places in the world that's thinking more clearly. But like, yes, it's a tough, tough climate for that. We're doing our part by like making peer-to-peer. Like peer-to-peer is basically uncensorable in this aspect, because again, like it's a million bajillion devices. So like we don't have any control over anything.
Yes.
I
know this is sticky, but I presume then, you know, I'm thinking of Durov and Telegram and other conversations, mm-hmm. you know, his interviews recently, and these things have bubbled up. You know, as some have said, it's the once upon a time Google adage, don't be evil, to can't be evil. And yeah. So we must, in order, you know, to preserve these freedoms, these liberties, make it impossible to conduct mass surveillance. And you know, there are those who will cry, what about the children? I'm a father. That's not lost on me. But I would say get a warrant. So that's my little monologue on this. But well, you talked to a couple of times, which I think is very important, Matthias, the bigger picture. So what are the biggest cultural and technical, in the sense of sort of end user adoption, hurdles to widespread uptake of peer to peer? You know, what do you hear? What do you run up against day in and day out?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think actually, like I said, it's like the time is pretty good for that, because it's something that's on everybody's mind, both the security aspect. We had that recently in Europe. There was a power outage in Spain and France, and I think even though it was like just for half a day, we had have some colleagues there, and they were telling me how quickly things roll into anarchy when basic services stop working, right? So like immediately they were like, oh, we need to add this thing to the P2P network so we can run it in these scenarios and stuff like that, to ensure that that's very, very important. So I think people are waking up to these things because it's becoming reality really fast. There's also just a way, from a consumer's point of view, the internet has evolved. Like, you know, I'm not personally like necessarily a big fan of this, but you know how like we have a big influencer economy now and stuff like that. I think one thing people learn over and over and over again is kind of like, you can go to a centralized platform and you can have a bajillion followers and you can be very popular. As soon as that platform decides to shut you off for whatever reason, maybe you did something wrong, maybe you didn't, you'll understand that you actually have nothing. You're just you're a user in a database.
Yes.
And very quickly you get radicalized on like data sovereignty and like ownership. We're going to see more and more of that. It's going to be more and more awareness being spread like that about like you actually, as a content creator, you have to own your own content. You have to own your own rights. From users' point of view, it's the same thing. It's kind of like that you can have just data sovereignty. I have a conversation with you and we can do a DM and we know just from a technological point of view that this is like just between us. That's really, really important. I think one of the biggest hurdles is just like I said, like there's obviously complexity in that. And like, you know, this stuff has to be 100%. We found out, I think, just from our experience and like a lot of our battle scars, is like you can get a technology like 99% and you feel pretty good, but that one more percent can really hurt you in terms of like adoption. So that's really, really important. Luckily, we're racing really fast towards that. So I think it's kind of like, and it's also interesting because we're just as technological people, we're like, you know, obviously proud of what we're building and peer-to-peer, but at the end of the day, people don't care because they shouldn't care. They just want apps that work. They want apps that work in any scenario. If the internet turns off, if there's a billion users, if we go bankrupt, it should still work. And that's just the kind of product we're trying to build. So kind of like our first thought it's always like, oh, let's put like this crazy progress bar with all the peers on there. And we're like, no, it's just like, just be simple because that's what people want. So that's what drives adoption, like just good apps and stuff. So I think it's like time is on our side, and I think a lot of people are waking up to it. If I just think about it also just as an analogy, with, you know, Bitcoin, how that used to also be very, very niche in terms of like just what people cared. And now it's something, it went through like a phase of being very niche and then like, let's get rich really fast. And now it's something I hear about in terms of just like sound financial instrument in terms of like combating the times we live in terms of like
tackling inflation
and stuff, like kind of like this third evolution. And for me, it's the same way people go through. It's like, it was like the crazy, like, I can't get this content, let me get this content piracy, to like, let's make free networks that scale really fast, to being like, no, I just want to have stable communications with everybody, and everything else is kind of like has outages because of reasons, or I get censored. And that's that last stage we need to get into.
Right.
And that's what we're moving really fast towards.
And with that, I mean, I might imagine, as you've described it, Matthias, that you see Holepunch's role as, and I mean this, I think in the way that you do, pipes and plumbing. Not sexy because it shouldn't be, because it doesn't need to be, because it needs to just work like my plumbing works. How close to the end user do you need to be, want to be? I mean, is Keat almost a proof of concept? Do you foresee a you know, sort of a portfolio of apps? Like, where do you guys sort of sit?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, we originally, so like you said, we're an infrastructure company, but also infrastructure by itself. That's kind of like one of my critiques about a lot of blockchain projects. It will be like, here's some infrastructure, but it's kind of like, you know, you want to do something else. We wanted to make an app on top because A, communications is insanely important. We want to put our mark in that. And also, we want to make the hottest app up front so that when the hottest app works, we know everything works. And actually, it's kind of funny because people think about a chat app as like, oh, it's just some messages and a box. But if you start thinking about it, like a chat app is like, it's both like a multi-user system where tons of chaos comes in. So it's also like a file sharing network where you can add files and pictures. It's also like crazy connectivity. People have it in their phone and stuff. It's like, it's actually all the hard problems at once. And
it stress tests everything.
So it's kind of like, so for us, it was like, when the chat app is perfected, everything else is perfected because it's all the same components. So we took down that challenge immediately. Honestly, we're still like, there's still stuff to figure out, but like, we're very, very big believers in like, freedom of communication and stuff. So we're going to keep having it be our flagship. I use Keat all the time to talk to just people on the P2P network. It's been a very interesting journey, just also from a technological point of view, because you learn some of the interesting parts of a P2P app, which is like, I don't know who I'm talking to half of the time because I'm just talking to random users. The users have these random names because there's no phone numbers or things like that. So it's kind of like you learn how to, when you don't have any metadata about people, it actually frames the conversation differently. And like, there's always some device out there that's running some different version, because again, you don't have any control over any network. It's like a beast by itself. But my point is like, communication is just alpha omega, and especially even more than we realized when we started in the world we're in now, it's like getting more and more important than ever.
Yes. And I mean, that's, you know, people, I worked in the data center business once, and you hear a reference to five nines, you know, you need 99.999% uptime. And I think that has now transferred to consumer expectations. They want, you know, nearing 100% of whatever it is that they have come to expect from that particular application, that particular use case. And as you say, chat is extremely difficult. So with that, let's get into the question that, you know, I've got to ask, and I'm sure you love to talk about, which is open source.
Sure.
And so, you know, I did put out on Nostr, hey guys, I'm speaking to Matthias. What do we want to know about? And the one thing that came back, you know, and we'll hopefully make this appealing or approachable for those who are not developers, but certainly developers as well. So, you know, Keat has faced criticism for not being fully open sourced. And I do want to get into and let you talk about what that means. You know, the arrows that get shot at you are therefore, could it, you know, is it verifiable code, potential backdoors, all of that. So How do you respond to these critiques, and what plans does Hole Punch have to address these demands?
So first of all, it's something I love to talk about. I love to talk about open source in general. I often talk about it on Qt also. I should probably sticky a message on Qt so people have a thing to read to. So it's interesting to think about some of the challenges about making a peer-to-peer app, because I think I talked about that already. So when you make a peer-to-peer app, you don't have a central server, obviously. You have an app, and I run the app, and you run the app. So first of all, if you open something like that too early, as you get with open source, you get this explosion of clients. Now, that's a good thing, I think, in general, but it can be a very, very tough thing for a project that's trying to iterate a serious infrastructural project.
So breaking changes to the protocol.
Which we do all the time. So it's kind of like, so one of the things that people also talk about on Qt is every time we issue an update on Qt, there's a box that says update the app, and you're not allowed to use the app until you update it. And people sometimes are like, maybe that's annoying. And I'm like, yeah, I totally understand why it's annoying. But if we don't have that, it'll take us 20 years because we literally have to move software to your device because there is no other device.
Right.
And if your software is behind, then everything becomes, much, much slower for us. And at the end of the day, as much as I love to appeal to this crowd, what I want to target is the big crowd, our parents, everybody. And I don't want to lose out to something that's dystopian in that sense from my point of view.
Right. So without a back end, you have no Tower of Babel to translate protocol changes. So they have to, you could either bloat every client, every app to, address every change in the protocol, or you have to push.
So just from making Qt right now with those restrictions, that the UI is closed, so we have one version that we control, we have one deployment updates of force. Just with those restrictions, it's still actually, compared to just deploying code to a server, it's still harder for us because we have to deploy it and then we have to wait a little bit. So it spreads out through the network and before we do something big changes, because we also don't want to disrupt people's experience and stuff like that.
You don't flip the switch until you've got a certain level of deployment or penetration.
And it's security software, and so that's encryption and stuff. You don't want to do things too much. So it's already a very, very big challenge with those limitations, which is one of the main reasons we do it. So for us, especially during this iteration phase, it's just really, really important to just be able to do that, those big movements, and do them really fast. Another thing that was very concerned for us in the beginning was also at the infancy of a project. Obviously, it's risk. I had that happen a lot with my other open source stuff, where somebody will fork it and put a shit coin in it. I don't know if I can say that in the podcast. But
absolutely, you can.
That's good. Just going back to there's just many, many ways of hindering this project from getting off the ground. And that's again what we care about. We care about getting that multi-million user adoption for the masses, so we can get these things actually. Don't want to be a niche thing, but get them deployed very, very widely.
Right, right.
That's big part of the reason why we do it, and the main part actually. I always say, this might sound fluffy, I don't mean it fluffy, but we always evaluate where we are and the roadmap on that. Things can change anytime, but right now for us, it's just very, very important to get that stage where we don't have to do that, and then our options become clearer about other things we can do. So to counter that, because I can totally hear the argument, we then try to take everything that's not the app and make it open source so we can actually have that contribution. So we have I can't remember how many, 2,000 repositories across the different things people can contribute to. Because we actually, like I said, I'm a big believer of open source and stuff. And we want to get those contributions. We want to get the stuff reviewed and stuff like that. So that's kind of how we try to counter what I just said.
And is there a consistent license across those, Matthias, or does it vary?
Well, licenses are really, really tough because it's all permissive license. I think most of it is Apache now. We used to do MIT, it's all permission license.
So the most permissive, if not the, I'm not an expert, but.
Yeah. The only license that really, in my opinion, works, the rest is too complicated. But I'm not a lawyer. Don't sue me.
Yes.
Like I said, open source is really important to me. And we consistently, as we get through to that mission, open up more and more. But again, just to iterate, it's not to be evil, it's not to do anything. It's just we want to hit that target of iteration speed and have people have an app that just moves fast and is always up to date.
Got it. Thank you. And is there an intention? Is there a commitment? Maybe it's there and I missed it. To open source Qt when the time is right? Has that decision been made?
right now, so just to be, I try to be as least fluffy as I can, but like right now, the only thing that matters for us is that main adoption. And once we hit that, we'll then evaluate where we are. And that thing, it's a little bit hard to say when that happens, because like, it's just really, really sophisticated software at the end of the day. But like, obviously we will reevaluate these things as we go along. And all through that journey, our goal is to get as close to 100% as possible. Like, I think there's more important things than that on that front. Kind of like, if we don't have open devices anyway, I actually think it matters very little, because you don't know what software you're getting anyway. I'm not saying that it's like that necessarily has to.
Sure. Well, and like, my observation would be, and I hear you. I mean, as I mentioned, you know, before we got started, I have sort of two halves to my brain. One is suit. One is nerd. And I keep them, I think, in pretty decent balance. So we talked about monetization. You know, you've got a partner who's got probably one of the highest margins in history. And so I know money is, you know, never to be wasted, but it's not probably a primary concern. But where I'm going with that is, presumably monetization is somewhere on the, mm-hmm. on the roadmap, yep. for a whole bunch. Tell me, you know, otherwise. But what's most interesting to me is, if we zoom out, let's just sort of set aside the academic and sort of, you know, legalistic definitions of open source and do you or don't you do it. What does it do? How does it hinder that army of open source developers that perhaps you do or don't want building on Hole Punch right now? So, you know, and I'll raise, you know, again, something's probably nattering in your ear all the time, is BitChat, you know, Jack Dorsey's mm-hmm. Vibe Code project and Noster. Yeah. These are not the same things. But talk to me about Hole Punch's, your perspective as the CEO on how open source or not factors in to recruiting an army to build applications on your infrastructure.
Well, first of all our infrastructure is open. Our entire platform is open.
Yes.
And like we have a very vibrant community of people building things. It's still very early in like a lot of apps, but like I'm a big believer in that. Like open source is interesting because it's like there's open source for people who've been in open source for a long time, like myself, and then there's open source for people a little bit outside open source, and I can see how that differs. Like,
sure.
Just from a personal experience.
It's like, a brand versus a mechanism or an approach.
I always personally done open source because I was like, here's something for the world to consume if they want to. And then you realize that this is not always the case, but it's mostly the case. People don't contribute back. That's not a bad thing. It's just that that's not really how it works. It's just more like you can use it if you want to. And some people will send you bug reports. But this like magic world of people coming in and we all collaborate on things together seldomly happens. It happens sometimes, but it seldomly happens. And when it does, it leads to other things. So I'm not a personal big believer of that. I think other people are, but I'm not personally a big. But I'm a very big believer of like open infrastructure and everybody builds things in open platforms. Now with other apps and stuff, yeah, like it's the same thing. There's a bunch of cool things there, and I think that's cool. I actually think I looked through some of the BitChat code just to see how they did some of the meshing, because I'm like, I wonder how they do it compared to how
others right.
do it. And like, I would encourage those people to look through our Swarm code to be the same thing. Like, that's just good practice. We recently ran a conference here in Lugano called the P2P Summit, where we also
yes.
tried to invite a bunch of people from different projects that I think one of my friends said, like, aren't they a competitor? I'm like, yeah, but it doesn't matter because it's open infrastructure, right? So it's kind of like, if they can make their thing better, I'm fine with that. Like, I don't have to compete with their open infrastructure. If they can make our thing better, that's fine. So that stuff really works, I think. And like, open ideas really work. Now, in terms of monetization, yeah, like, you don't really monetize open source apps. I think that's just like how it is. You need, like, that doesn't mean you don't make money. It just means that like,
certainly.
Like classic idea of like
Red Hat figured it out, you know, way yeah. back, right? Services, which I presume presumes there's infrastructure to maintain on behalf of a client. It's different without any.
Yeah. So what's very interesting about peer-to-peer, what I think about a lot, and it's actually funny you said the thing about Tether and like profit margins, because when we started out and when I started working with Tether, that was when Tether was tiny, like,
didn't yes, really exist right, in the scale, right.
Which I'm very happy about because that means that we get off on the right foot on that.
Yes.
But what's very interesting about peer-to-peer is that obviously there's no operational cost, or at least that's very fixed operational cost. So obviously I pay, we have a bunch of developers and they get a salary, but my cost tomorrow is the same as my cost today, whether or not Keat takes off or not.
Mm.
So from a planning point of view and like a profitability point of view, that's a much easier equation for me, because that means that I can think about these things in terms of like, what do we want to sell and what service do we want to do? And there's tons of stuff you can do on a P2P network. Like you can do partnerships, you can do all kinds of stuff, like
Absolutely.
More classical things. But the graphs are more like the costs are here and then your profit, like your income
Lumpy.
Stuff goes up. Yeah, I'm right there, right? Now, will there be a situation where like every user in a peer-to-peer open source app makes you X amount of money? I don't think so, personally. It's like, but I'm also, maybe there will be, but like you can definitely easily make profitable apps. So it's a very interesting question. And we, in Lugano, we also run, as part of the Plan B network here, which is the Bitcoin network, there's like a summer school where a bunch of students come in. And we love to ask them this question of like, imagine a world where there's like fixed expenses, but you don't have this kind of like gatekeeping. Like, what's the kind of business model you would think about? And it's very interesting to see what things people come up with, but it's just much more classical businesses in terms of like these kind of like modern centralized businesses. It's more like,
Right. Well,
we sell this thing and we made a margin. And we sell this thing from Denmark. Maybe for Keat, that means, you know, hardware is important. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it means that, you know, like I said, partnerships. Maybe it means that we sell, you know, I'm just saying things like.
Sure, licensing, embedding, on, all these
emoji
things.
Emoji packs, I don't know. Like, it's
I mean, you know, like, gaming, you can look to gaming, so many use cases or so many revenue lines.
There's all kinds of things, but it's not going to be classical in that sense. And I think that's the same for any kind of other app. And I think, thinking about Noster, thinking about BitChat, it's like, for me, it's all good. Like, you know, we all want the same thing. We want to have the world move towards these platforms. There's going to be different takes on doing it. That's fine. That's how these things work. But like, we want that mission, which is like, let's get decentralized providers out and get these decentralized providers in.
Yeah. I hear you. Well, in all of that, let's zoom out a bit. Matthias, give us your vision for what success looks like. Is that 5 years? Is it 10 years? Whatever. But what are we as individuals experiencing in, call it 5 years, with hole punch peer-to-peer successful? What does life look like?
It's a good question. I have many different ideas of success. I don't even know if I want to call all of it that, but I think, so we set out, when we made this company, we kind of had this like decision to make internally, like, do we want to just try to make a straight up classic successful company, or do we want to make something else? Like a classic successful company, we always, our internal trope for that is like, let's make a dating app and be very successful.
Built to flip, built to sell.
And we explicitly said no to that, and we said, let's try to actually do something where that upside is much, much harder, but like where the mission is much, much grander. That's what we were driven by. That's all our backgrounds, which is like business school wise a terrible idea, but that's what we were driven by. So the reason I say that is that it kind of like opens up this very wide range of like, what does success mean? Because one part of success is like, the entire world is running on P2P technology. I'm bankrupt and living somewhere else. But like, that's some measure of success that I would say. It's not very good personal success, but it's still like part of the mission. But obviously the success we're looking for is like, defeat the status quo, get all these centralized providers to basically stop existing and have people give their data sovereignty back and have private installable communications and data. It's as simple as that. And on a level playing field where it doesn't matter if you're in a big jurisdiction or a small jurisdiction, it's just like I said in the beginning, the power of it, the individual and the devices you own should be the only thing that matters in this like technological world. And right now it definitely isn't. So that's for me. And on top of that, build a sustainable business so we can keep funding these things and develop it, because I think also it's utopia to think that we just make these things and like stop, right? So we need, it's like, there's always going to be some new challenge. There's always some arms race going on with like trying to
Absolutely.
Penetrate networks and stuff. So I would say like, it's crazy to me that we set out on this really intense mission. I talked to a lot of funders and they're all like, what are you doing?
I'm sure they have lots of recommendations for you.
they're all like, maybe we should do a coin. I'm like, well, we don't do the coin also.
So they're like, yeah.
So my point is like, we worked on this for a long time. We got it to work. We found the money through relationships and stuff that are very, very committed. We got that to work. And somehow also the world is moving to a place where peer-to-peer is important. So I'm like, those three events don't happen by accident. So I'm always like driven by that. I'm like, we have a mission we need to execute and we are executing it. And that's really, really important. And that's for me what success looks like.
Excellent. Well, and what really stuck with me or struck me as you were speaking, Matthias, is just as those of us who use Bitcoin, and I think see Bitcoin as a preeminent tool, can memorize 12 words as the trope, but it's true, goes and cross borders with our wealth. What I heard you say, which really struck me, was to be able to change jurisdictions, cross borders with a powerful device and the necessary software and connectivity to do the things we wish to do without thinking, you know, is this permitted here? Is there a great firewall? Is there, you know, some sort of ban on VPNs? And I appreciate that these technical problems don't go away. But as a vision, I think that's powerful. It's just as I can memorize 12 words and cross a border and have my wealth, I can hold in my hand a device I own, running peer-to-peer powered software, cross a border and do what I need to do. I think that's really powerful.
Yeah. And like, if you think about it, it's also how we fight the bureaucrats, right? Because like, how do you stop a population that has financial aspects of that and communication aspects of like and general data independence like that? Like, what's holding you back then from being like, well, I don't like it here, I'm going to go somewhere else? Because at the end of the day, those are the things that the future is going to be built on. And so, yeah.
Absolutely. 100%. I keep waiting for somebody to rewrite or update the sovereign individual for these things. Well, let's wrap up here. You did mention your P2P summit, and I'd like to get a reflection on that. And then maybe integrate that, Matthias, into for builders, developers, business owners, product people. Let's say, and I hope they do, that they buy into the fact that peer-to-peer is increasingly important and it must be part of the way forward. What do they need to do strategically, operationally, to get ready and ultimately to build on peer-to-peer? I almost said peer-to-peer, so you probably know where I'm going with that, but you take my point.
Yeah, I think, so first of all, like, it's still early. Like, Bitcoin is still early also. Like, it's less early than it used to be, but it says, like, peer-to-peer is even earlier. What you need to do is, like, I found this myself, like, coming up through a university system and stuff like that. And this is not even because the system is sinister, but you get programmed into thinking a certain kind of way. And so, like, I came out of the system thinking, like, this is the only way to build things. You have to have these servers. You have to do these things. This is just how it's taught. If you want to get a good grade, that's how you do it. You need to learn how to deprogram. And that sounds easy, but it's really hard, which means, like, you need to start thinking, like, these crazy things of, like, what if we just didn't have this aspect? How can we still do things? What if we just didn't have servers? What if I wanted to make a video service where like the video was just always insane quality and it wouldn't cost anything? That sounds wrong, right? But we can do that. And then the next thing is like, how can I, you know, meet people that think that same way and get feedback, whether I'm like a business person or a developer or what I am. It's not even to plug our app, but like on Keith, we have a very vibrant community on that for P2P things. I would just join that. We have a bunch of different people and we jam out to these questions every day because they're very interesting. So as a person trying to do something in the world, I think that's very, very important to think. Now, also, if you're like, as more other people are, if you're a little bit cautious, you don't have to like go full peer-to-peer from the beginning, right? You can make like an app where you have certain aspects of the app be peer-to-peer and other things not, if that's like something that suits you better. But I always think about it in terms of like, for me, it's like it's where things are going really fast. I use this analogy once in a while of like the internet before encryption and the internet after encryption. Because when I came up, people were looking at HTTPS, the encryption layer on the internet, being like, "Do we really need that? It sounds really complicated."
Now the little SSL badge on the bottom of the website. Yeah,
and it was always like always these discussions of like, "Oh, you should do it on this, but not on this." And it was kind of like, it reminds me a lot of the P2P discussion today. And then now, 5-10 years later, we look back and we're like, what were we thinking? Like, that was
absolutely
the most crazy discussion ever. Of course, you need to encrypt everything all the time. That's how I see peer-to-peer going. So that's why you need to educate you about yourself today, because like in 5-10 years, you're going to look back and be like, why did we ever give Google this data? That's crazy. Also for like the way, just like we said, jurisdictions, regulation is going, it's going to be much more important. These kind of like sovereignty, the bureaucrats might not know it, but it's also like kind of like the world they're building. So you need to get educated now. You don't have to be a technical person. You just need to kind of like understand the concepts. Again, join Keith, join our channels there, and talk to us.
Super. And how does one, you know, given that it's peer-to-peer and not centralized, how does one discover those spaces, yeah, those channels on Keith?
Yeah, that's
let's give viewers, listeners, so a 1-2-3 get started.
So the only thing we run centralized is our website. We have a website because you need a way to get the app, unfortunately, right now.
Of course.
Keith.io, you go there, you download the app. After you download the app, we actually have a list of rooms we hard code just for like new users. So you want to get like an entryway. We have our development room and stuff. That's just rooms that are still peer-to-peer, but it just kind of like has the invite there to Bootstrap. Once you're in Keith, then users will just exchange links themselves. There's like a room of rooms and stuff, which is kind of fun.
Right, right.
And they're all like entryways through there. So it's a really, really fun community. It's very fun for us because we don't know half of what's going on. We don't even know like anything that's going on. We hear things through the grapevine. But join a couple of those suggested rooms. That's where all the hole punchers hang out. Also, we'll try to guide people through an experience. But also, it's early, right? So like, people are friendly, people are online, happy to help anybody run their peer-to-peer journey.
Fantastic. It's been great. I really appreciate it, Matthias. Delighted to hear that you have, as I expected you would, the sort of philosophical and the underlying motivation, you know, to do a lot of very important things. So I will make sure all these links are in the show notes. I appreciate it. Hope we can catch up soon and see how things are going. And we'll talk soon. Thank you, Matthias.
Thanks for having me.
All the best. Bye-bye.